Let me introduce you, Christopher Luscombe, for those of you that don't know. Now, just to give you a brief overview of what Christopher has done in his career, if we may. I got this off of Wikipedia / Google, so I hope it's right. If Christopher's face at any time goes, no, we'll know about it. So Christopher began his theatre career as an actor.
I did.
First in Cambridge University Drama Club Footlights, and later in Rep at the National Theatre and here at the RSC. Some of you may have seen him. Some nodding heads. As a director, his many credits, too many to list, include productions of Alan Bennett's In Joy for the Peter Hall Season, The History Boys, and the comedy of errors The Merry Wives of Windsor at London's Globe, and the Spamalot UK tour. So quite a varied, very varied CV there, I would say. First of all, Chris, can you tell us a little bit how you moved from being a very successful actor, you were here for a number
moderately
of years.
Moderately successful, I think.
He's too modest. To moving to into the breadth of direction that you've done. How does one person? How do you move?
Well,
from
actually, I think it was a lot to do with the RSC because I was here for 7 years actually through the 90s, and while I was here, I put together a show called the Shakespeare Review, which we did in the Swan on a Sunday night, and. Did it with some friends in the company, and it was a collection of comic material about Shakespeare, and I put it together and with a view to being in it with my friends. It was just a Sunday night charity show, so it felt like someone had to shepherd the actors around or direct the traffic, really. And so I took that on, and I directed the show, but it wasn't really I didn't feel like I was the director, but I did direct it. And then that show grew and grew and became a part of the RSC repertoire, and then it went into the West End. And so suddenly, with absolutely no intention at all, I was a West End director. and it was, I suppose life is like that, isn't it? These things happen by accident, really. And I really enjoyed that experience. I enjoyed having the control of the whole production rather than just being one part of it. And I also enjoyed working with the designer and the lighting designer and the producer and all the different people who work on the show. So I got a real kick out of that, but I assumed I was going to go back to acting again, and in fact I did go back to acting for a couple of years, and during those 2 years I became increasingly keen on the idea of having another go at directing. It just became a sort of obsession and a yearning, rather similar to my feelings about becoming an actor in the first place. I just was sort of desperate to have another go, and it became so intense, that feeling, that I then thought I'd better give it a go. And I found a Noel Coward play that had never been performed before called Star Quality, the last play that Noel Coward ever wrote, and it was unperformed. And very fortunate that I got hold of it and managed to... I chatted to Penelope Keith, who I'd got to know a bit at that time in my life, and she said she would be in it, and I took it to a producer and got that on in the West End. And... that was the big stepping stone, because having done that and directed a play rather than a review, I think a review people didn't really know where to place me. But after doing a play, they thought, oh, he can direct plays. And so then I just got offers for other plays. But it was an odd time in my life, because I was actually in art, the play art in the West End, as an actor while Star Quality was playing down the road. So I really did see these two strands of my life going alongside each other. And in a funny kind of way, although I adored doing art, it was a very happy experience. It was having the play I directed that was the big thrill.
And that's what made you go actually, down that I'm route. A director now.
Yeah.
So you performed for many years, 7 years,
yes.
Created something here, but this is your first time you've directed here, and you're doing two shows at the same time.
Yes.
Madness. Could you tell us a little bit how these two productions came about, how you were invited?
I was absolutely flabbergasted, to be honest with you. I still am. I'm still in a state of shock that I was offered these two plays. I hadn't been back to the RSC since that time as an actor, and always thought I'd love to, but it just hadn't come along, and I'd been busy doing these other shows. And then I got a call to go and have coffee with Greg Doran, who runs the company, as you know. And I thought it was just to have a cup of coffee. I don't know Greg well, but I collided with him when we were in the 90s, when I was here acting. And so I thought, oh, how lovely, I'll go and have a coffee with Greg. And during that, we had chatted about all kinds of things. And then he suddenly said, I've got this idea for a project. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I think I might be. And then he told me more about it and explained the idea of doing these two plays paired, and also his idea of placing them either side of the First World War to commemorate the First World War. And so he said, do you think it's a good idea? I said, I think it's a really good idea. And he said, well, if you do, and if you really believe in it, then I'd love you to direct it. In fact, I'd love you to direct them. And that was when I said, what, them? You mean both of them? And he said, yeah, I think it should be the same director on both shows. So it was all a wonderful surprise. And it felt
all
like
over one cup of coffee.
All over one. Yeah, I think we had a sandwich as well.
Okay.
but it was a sort of felt like a dream, really, and it still does. It's been the most incredible experience.
And in terms of that idea of these, the two plays straddling, or let's talk about Love's Labour's Lost.
Yeah.
But Love's Labour's Lost very much being set before the First World War, and
yes,
very much in that summer,
yes,
before it all happened. How do you feel? Why did that fit so nicely with this play?
I think it's become quite a well-known approach to Love's Labour's Lost to put it in that setting. I mean, I was in a production here myself in 1993. I was in a production of Love's Labour's Lost in this theatre, which was set at that period. So and I think Trevor Nunn did it like that at the National. So that isn't really a new idea. And I think the reason it fits so well is because we have this mythology that's built up around the First World War already, that the last great Edwardian summer was this perfect summer, everything was perfect. And I think that fits the play because the world these characters live in is so idyllic. Mm. They just sit around discussing life and poetry and language and things, and without a care in the world. It seems to be a very idyllic, utopian sort of world. And then, of course, at the end of the play, it's shattered with the news of the princess's father's death and the couple separating and the men going off to some unspecified, difficult endurance test. I think a lot of directors and academics have thought that that's could be seen as being akin to the end of that empire world pre-war, the men going off to the trenches, the women saying goodbye to them, and separation. And it just seems emotionally to fit. I also think there's something about Shakespeare comedy which works very well in a very ordered society where people know their place in the pecking order. And I personally believe that's very important. And I think other people have spotted that, and they find that if you set it in anything sort of up to about the Second World War, you can believe that people know their place. After that, no one really knows their place. I mean, I don't know my place. Do you know your place? I don't. But then they did, and the hierarchy is very clear. And so I think that's the Edwardian world seems to fit well. Love's Labour's Lost has such a range of characters from all classes, and they fit in very neatly into that.
It's a play that isn't performed very often. I mean, our last one was in 2008, fairly recently, but
yes,
before that, I believe it was about 15 years
yes,
before that. And I've just remembered that we have actually just spoilt the ending for a lot of people that might not have seen the show. Can I ask how many of you have already seen this production in its run so far? And I presume the rest of you are seeing it this evening. Okay, so we will try not to give away too much, but hopefully you know Shakespeare's stories. But it is a play that isn't performed very often. Mm. Is that to do with the fact that it is a play that, not a lot happens within it? That is, it is about people. It's about people enjoying the language,
yes,
enjoying playing. There are relationships amongst it, but you could say the real turning point is actually at the end of the play rather than somewhere in the midpoint of the play.
Yes. I think there's an element of truth about that. I think there are scenes in it where people just sit around chatting. And that's quite hard dramatically, I think. You have to love the characters, and you have to, even if you don't understand all the wordplay, of which there is quite a bit, you have to enjoy the fact that they're enjoying it, I think. Up to a point. I mean, I think it's... I was very keen that the audience do understand enough that they can sit back and have fun with it. Mm. But I think equally, There's two other points, I think. One is that the play has a very difficult ending, which we've just touched upon there, that what appears to be a very high-spirited, light comedy suddenly is... I'm going to spoil it for you now, but it is plunged into gloom. So that I think commercially that's, over the years, been seen as a difficult thing to deal with, and I think audiences naturally shy away from that. They want... romantic comedies should end happily, shouldn't they? And they almost always do. So it's a bit of a surprise, I think. And although it's very daring, and Shakespeare's very bold to do that, and that's one of the things that makes the play interesting, I think probably for producers it's quite a difficult factor. But we, of course, are benefiting from the fact that we're pairing it with a play where the lovers come together yes. in Much Ado, and then there is a happy ending. So we're sort of having our cake and eat it too, I suppose. And so there's a sort of cliffhanger ending at the end of this play, but it does eventually get resolved. And I think we like to have a happy ending. So that's satisfied. The other point I was going to make was that although you're right that there are scenes where nothing much happens, that is absolutely true, some of the play is very, very structured. And it does start with the most fantastic comic premise, I think, of these men turning their back on women. And then 5 minutes later, beautiful women walk in the door.
Which they'd forgotten about.
And then we see how they deal with that and how the women deal with them, and we watch their journey. It's very schematic, very neat, very symmetrical. Four handsome boys, four beautiful girls. And I think that there's something very, very satisfying about that. And that story is mixed in with these other eccentric characters who just love language. But I think there is a very neat thread. I felt that the play as written is very, very long for a modern audience, and so I have been bold about trimming it. And I think that's become the norm. I think other productions in the last 40, 50 years have trimmed it, but having been in it at Stratford, I think that was really helpful to me because I was able to remember back to how I thought it played with an audience. And... So I love doing the editing. That's one of the most enjoyable bits of the whole process. So, and I like to do that before we go into rehearsal. So I had a lot of fun working out the best way I felt we could serve it up, which all then, of course, gets modified when I meet the actors and work with them and we talk about it and things change. And they still change. I mean, it's amazing how in preview you do make changes because you hear how it works with an audience. It's really, that's where the work begins.
So I know people will be going, okay, so which parts have you cut? But more rather, I think the better question is, what leads you in that cutting? What are the, you know, is it, are there jokes that would have been well known by a Elizabethan audience that were very topical jokes that don't hold any sway anymore? But
it's a whole mixture of things, really. I think there's an element of that. I think it's an idea that Shakespeare wrote the play for a very specialist audience, a very rarefied audience, and that some of the references are very, very obscure. And I feel that there's a sort of happy medium, there's a sort of, you have to negotiate your way through that because you don't want to sanitize it or you don't want to oversimplify it or you don't want to just appeal to the lowest common denominator or whatever, you don't want to dumb down, but you want to make it an enjoyable experience for the general audience, and you want to do what you feel Shakespeare would do if he was in the room. Mm. I mean, that was always the sort of guiding principle, really, was trying to... I felt that he wrote the play to be really funny. It's a high comedy, and I wanted the audience to find it very funny. And sometimes you need to cut to the chase a bit and get rid of a little bit of the verbiage to get to the punchline, that sort of thing. I feel that otherwise it becomes a bit of a museum piece. It's getting the balance right of that, because you could just rewrite the whole thing and turn it into modern English, and of course I don't approve of that at all. I want to honour what he wrote, but open the doors to people who perhaps have never seen a Shakespeare play before. It's amazing how you can just tweak it. I'm giving away state secrets now, but we can, you know, occasionally reverse the order of a couple of words. Or maybe when I worked here, the first play I ever did here was The Alchemist with Sam Mendes directing. And the principle he applied was that if you replace one word in a really long, difficult speech with an alternative, a synonym, which is readily understandable by the audience. Suddenly, if the whole speech is unlocked by that, it's worth doing. And so we've had a lot of fun doing that, trying to work out where, and it's all a matter of opinion. It's all a matter of taste. And I suppose you try and encourage the actors to give their opinions on it, but guide them and get try to establish a sort of common view and a common way of working between the whole company. So we have a sort of similar taste over the whole thing. And I think that's what we've done there. They're great. And we've had a lot of fun with this sort of endless tweaking to make it work for a modern audience. But everything we've done, I think, comes out of a tremendous love of the play and a desire to share it with the audience because it is so fabulous.
I want to talk a little bit about the set. And again, I find it interesting. It's a Shakespeare play. Normally, Shakespeare takes us to different locations. In this play, he keeps us in one location. And you've been very specific about the location that you've placed this play in. So
yes.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, I was very fortunate in a way in that Greg gave me this concept, I suppose we'd call it, for placing the play before the First World War. That couldn't have been more specific. And so I saw nothing wrong with that at all. I thought that was just great. But I thought, well, how can I then develop that idea? And because Shakespeare places both this play and Much Ado About Nothing on a country estate, I thought it would be good if they were in the same location, so that would unify the two plays. And I thought it might be really good if it was an estately home. I mean, although this play is set in Navarre and Much Ado is set in Sicily, I think really, I mean, Shakespeare never went to these places as far as we know. And you feel when he's writing about an English stately home, an English estate. And so I thought that it would be good to place them in this country. They are very, very English plays, despite the sort of exotic set locations he puts them in. They are really meant to be, I think they're really Warwickshire. And I thought that it would be good to look at stately homes in Warwickshire to find somewhere that the local audience here would know. I mean, in a way, just so that we could be specific and so that the actors could go there, they could see for themselves this particular building, imagine being there in their characters. And I've always been a big fan of Charlecote Park down the road, 4 miles down the road, and it came to me very quickly. I thought initially that the designer and I would get in the car and drive round, but in fact, very quickly, Charlecote became the obvious contender. Yeah. Partly because of proximity, partly because it's an Elizabethan house, which seems to fit well with the language, but it was remodeled in the 19th century, so you could believe an Edwardian family living there, as indeed they did. And I like the fact that Shakespeare went poaching there. We don't know if he did for certain, but we think he might have done. I think it's fair to say he would have known Charlecote, even if he didn't go poaching there. And there is a deer park, which fits in with the deer park in the play. And it's just a beautiful place. So we went there. I went initially with the designer, took lots of photographs. The National Trust showed us all round, and it just fitted. It just felt right. And then we went back with all the production team and all the company, and it was great for them to experience it. And a lot of them had never been there before, and they just loved it. I think it's rooted the plays in a reality for us that we can believe in this family living there.
And when you were walking round, because I say it's set in one place, but you do take us on a whistle-stop tour of every room. Were you already in each room going, oh, this scene would sit very nicely in here as you were walking around?
Yeah, I wanted to have the fun of going to different locations within the estate. And I knew that the RSC has a great scenic workshop department, and I thought they could have fun with that. I just couldn't resist it, really. And when I thought of ideas like playing a scene in a billiard room or a drawing room or a library or up on the roof of the house, and these had associations. I mean, playing a scene on the roof had associations with Brideshead that I thought was really good.
There is the scene he's talking about, you will notice a teddy bear on stage, which is
a bit of a bright side
reference. It absolutely
plays
to what we know as an audience, or what we think we know of those type of people.
Exactly, those type of people around that sort of time. Bright side's a little bit later, but it still feels right to me. And I just couldn't resist doing those things, and I thought it would be fun for the cast to imagine very specific rooms and things, and they could think about how you behave in those different rooms. And the library at Charcot's very, very special. They have a second folio of Shakespeare there. It's got a great Shakespeare collection of Shakespeare books, and it even above the mantelpiece has this little motto: "Live to learn and learn to live." Mm. And I just thought that was so right for Love's Labour's Lost. Everything about it just seemed to fit into place, really. And I suppose, in a way, the main thing is it is a beautiful place. So for the designer to recreate that was very inspiring.
It does set up some absolutely beautiful set pieces in this space.
Yes.
And I wondered how this space influenced those set pieces at all, or whether purely Charcot influenced those set pieces, and how you create those set pieces in a rehearsal space. You know, is it playing that brings out these things? Is it what is it?
Gosh, difficult question, really, because it's a mixture of things. I think I was very keen to come in with ideas. I mean, one of the problems of putting on a play in any theatre company is that you have to design it before you start rehearsing it. So I had to make some choices. There's a room for a little bit of flexibility, but really, once you've decided on the roof, the billiard room, the drawing room, whatever these things are, you're pretty much, that's the way it's going to go. But and the actors, you hope they're going to buy into that. It's very scary because you present a model of the set on the first day of rehearsal and you hope they're going to like it and feel drawn to it. And thank goodness they did. I mean, that was a bit scary. I thought they might say, oh, why do we have to do it in 1914? Why do we have to do it at Charcot? You know, but they didn't. And you want them to buy into it, otherwise it's never going to work. But I think what I mainly felt was, if you say we'll do the big sonnet scene in Love's Labour's Lost on the roof of the house, as long as they like the idea of it, then they run with it. Mm. And between us in the rehearsal room, we think of ideas of how to make that come alive. We're fortunate here because, of course, the RSC has the facilities to build a mock-up of that in the rehearsal room. So we did have a sort of version of it. I've done a lot of shows where we've had to cope with just a few old chairs and tables thrown together to create things. But, we're very spoiled here. And I think I wanted to take advantage of that, really. I've done so many shows where I've had very little rehearsal time, very small budget. And it felt like this was an opportunity to think big, actually, and to push all the different departments. I mean, the costumes for this shows are unbelievable, I think. And there's a lot of them, and they're fabulous. But I thought, well, we've got all these brilliant people who work across the road there who can make... I don't think I've ever done a show before where everything has been created from scratch. You know, a lot of shows you do, people, the management hire in costumes. Here, we could have exactly what we wanted. And I was working with a designer who I've worked with a lot in commercial theatre, and we've never had that chance. So it was a great opportunity to go to town.
And what are the challenges of working in this space? Is this a first Thrust space, or you've worked in the
I've worked actually quite a lot recently in Thrust Theatre, okay. So it's becoming a bit the norm for me. I don't know why, but just the way it's fallen out recently. Because I did Henry V in Chicago directly before this, which was, they have a Thrust Theatre there, and I've worked at the Sheffield Crucible quite recently. Did Hay Fever, the Coward play in Minneapolis, which was an unusual chance to do a Coward play in the Thrust stage. So I've done quite a bit of that, but it's very, very demanding.
And it's a big set for a Thrust stage, I would say, from experience.
Yes, exactly. I think in recent years they haven't done much here in the way of big set changes. They tend to have one set which adapts for all different occasions, and with this there's quite a lot of stuff. But I like that. I like stuff. I think that's sort of one of the reasons I went into the theatre, was because I loved the magic of the theatre, and I wanted to kind of push the magic. But I hope it does look magical at times, and you don't know quite how it's all being done.
I think it's also the set changes that are still scenes.
Yes.
in a different way to perhaps how we might, you know, we tend to do set changes with lots of people moving.
Running on
and
off,
instead,
yes.
we've
yes.
got something quite magical yeah. that happens, yeah. but the scene continues yes, without giving too much away. It's yeah. really difficult.
I was very keen to, because I've done a lot of shows where actors have all run on and picked up the furniture and run off again, but I just felt with this I wanted it to be more elegant and for it just to happen effortlessly. And I because I knew we have a brilliant automation department. I mean, I've never worked in a theatre with an automation department before, and there's quite a few of them, and they are brilliant. And you knew that if you presented them with the challenge, they would run with it, and they've enabled us to do that. So it's been just fantastic.
And that also means that there's a lot of underscoring that starts, you know, fairly into the scene and through the scene.
Yeah.
So could you just talk a little bit about...
Well, that's really because I've worked quite a bit with Nigel Hess, who has composed the score for both of these shows, and he's just a genius, really. And we worked here together when I was an actor, and then we've worked together at the Globe, Shakespeare's Globe. And so when I knew I was going to do these plays, I thought he could... These were great... I mean, there's a great deal of music in them anyway, and I knew that Nigel would always write me a bit more as well if I asked him nicely. So, and I suppose because of these big scene changes and keeping it very fluid and cinematic in a way, I knew we'd have to have music to accompany that and to time seamlessly, I hope, on a good night with all that. So I suppose I wanted to create the atmosphere of Edwardian England and post-war England going into the 1920s. And I thought a good way to do that would be with music. It's interesting how, although Charlecote itself, the house, remained the same, of course, over those years, the people in it, their clothes would change, the music they listened to would change. And so we were able to reflect that in the design and the music. And it was, I just enjoyed all that. I just wanted to look at what was happening in the way of popular music around the time and then get Nigel to do brilliant pastiche of it. To the point, I think, where these songs come up and the audience feel they've known them all their lives, and actually they haven't, and they're hearing them tonight for the first time.
I'm going to hand it over to questions from you. So if you've got one on what we've just been talking about, or there's a question I haven't asked, so have a little thought about that. Final point for me, in terms of the I'm going to call them the boys
yes.
and the ladies, because
yes.
they ain't girls,
no.
they're ladies, and the
yeah.
boys are very much boys.
Yes.
And there is something about not only their actions, but also their use of language that the two groups use through the course of the play, where we see the boys kind of growing up, and we're very taken by their enthusiasm, I would say,
yes.
as an audience member.
Yes.
But I would say I came away going, I truly believe that you've fallen in love. So could you talk a little bit about the language within the play and the differences between the two groups?
The two groups. Well,
and how they change, if they change in your viewpoint.
How the characters
change. Yeah.
Well, I think it's sort of quite obvious, really, that the men and the women are written very differently. And although the men are very, very charming and likeable and fun, they're also... They're children, really. And the women feel very poised and sophisticated and superior, actually, in virtually every way. No change, exactly. And I think it's a great feminist play, really, that the women seem to have an emotional intelligence that the boys just don't have. But I'd like to feel by the end of it, there's a coming together. Mm. And I mean, we're very lucky because we then get to do the second play where that develops, I think. But in this particular play, one of the great challenges is the verse in it, because it's there's a lot of verse and a lot of rhyming verse, very formal, structured, artificial language, which you have to honour and yet make it feel natural and make them feel like they're talking as human beings. And one of the great discoveries, really, of doing it with an audience is that audiences enjoy the artificial language. I suppose in the way of other high comedies, you think of like Oscar Wilde or Coward, in fact, where people don't really talk quite like we do now, but there's a style to it. And I think audiences enjoy that style. And I keep on saying to the actors, do honour the rhymes. There's a pleasure in that. There's a pleasure in the rhymes. Mm. And often the laughs are there because of the neatness of the rhyme.
Yes, it's either, it seems to be, for the boys, there's a playful rhyme.
Yeah.
For the girls, it tends to be a put-down rhyme.
That might well be true, actually, yeah. I hadn't really thought of it like that, but I think that's probably true. Yes, what else to say about that? I just feel that the boys do sort of grow up. Mm. I suppose we're left thinking that really when they leave at the end, they're going to really grow up.
We won't give that away.
Won't give that away. I don't know. I'd be interested perhaps to know what the audiences think about that, really.
Okay. So a question about how much as a director do you rein back? How much do you have to encourage people to... there was a note about you being a very visual comedic actor. So how do you balance those two things of depth of character and humour, I guess
the
question is.
So I suppose I really encourage the actors to think about the physical life of the characters and to, in as they're creating them, to let their imaginations run wild as to what these characters might do, to base it very closely in the world of the play. And I suppose I've just encouraged them to think about the nitty-gritty of everyday life in a stately home in 1914. There wasn't much nitty-gritty about it, unless you were downstairs, I suppose. But you know, the everyday stuff. And I think probably I've thought of things as we've gone along, and so have they, and then we edit it, and the rest of the creative team think of things. And it's very much a collaborative environment, I hope. And everyone chips in and everyone has ideas, and I suppose it's my job in a way to edit them and to guide it. But I love it when people are able to suggest things, and when they begin to really imagine that world, stuff comes up. And I as regards the sort of tight rein, you'd have to ask the actors, really. I think it is quite a tight ship in that sense. I'm quite specific about exactly what we're doing when. It's very, I hope, I might be kidding myself, but I think it's quite ordered, but I want it to have a freedom within that. And if something happens on a particular night, they can run with it. We might then discuss it afterwards and decide whether to pursue it, but I don't want anyone to feel straitjacketed. I would absolutely hate it if they did. And I think that actors like to know exactly what world they're in, and they feel safe within that, and then they're safe to invent stuff. I do love physical business. I'm just fascinated. Well, I'm just fascinated by comedy, really, and what makes people laugh, and how you can. I think I often get asked when I'm directing these sort of plays, how do you make a play like this funny 400 years after it was written? And I suppose I think those little physical things are very good for unlocking the text and getting and drawing an audience in. And it's sometimes it's they can remember a character because of a particular physical moment. The audience sort of find that they can relate to that. I mean, it's very true, isn't it, that if you've got a difficult Shakespearean speech being spoken over here and you've got someone over there doing something silly with a computer, you will look at that. You'll always go with the physical thing. So the thing is, I suppose, to unite them and make an audience listen because you're doing something fascinating. And also, I think sometimes activity, physical activity, can help to take the curse off a very set speech. It's actors seem to like having stuff to do, but it has to be all very focused. It's so much about focus. And in fact, working at Shakespeare's Globe was very good for developing ideas about focus and how you tell the audience where to look when, and that's how you get the laugh. Because in the Globe, there are so many distractions. Planes, rain, thunder, whatever, you know. And here, it's much easier to achieve that, although the thrust stage is a challenge from that point of view.
Okay, so a question about how the two plays, sitting both sides of the wall, and how you approached those two differences.
Yeah, well, it's a great question, but and I could sort of rabbit on all night, really, about it. But I suppose I was keen to establish right from the word go of the second play that the world has changed. And yet we're sitting it in the same place. So the sort of, very early on, I had this thought that if the first play, Love's Ever Lost, takes place, it opens in the library of the house, because this is the boys committing to this oath they've written about studying for 3 years and not fraternising with women and all that. I thought that we should start the second play in the same place, but everything's changed, so that in our imaginations, the house has been requisitioned as a hospital, and the furniture has been shipped out, and all hospital beds have been put in, and the women in the house have become nurses, and the men are in military uniform. And it just felt like that was a very good, again, a visual way, really, of telling the audience right from the word go that the world has changed, and that all that elegant, beautiful furniture is gone, and it's iron bedsteads and things. So I think that, I mean, I was quite conscious when we began to really look at the plays that although Much Ado is set, I've talked about this on Monday really, but although it's set in a post-war world, Shakespeare is not really that interested in war in the play. He doesn't talk very much about it. And although the men, you feel that they are, I think they're believable as professional soldiers or experienced soldiers, I should perhaps say, they quickly get back into civilian life. And after the first scene or two, no one really refers to the war again. Because I think probably in Shakespeare's mind, the war they come from is not that much more than a skirmish, whereas we've just lived through the First World War. So it's a very different thing. But I think it kind of works. And I wanted to explore that. And so we pushed it. But I think what was handy in a way, I think, was that Much Ado is very often presented in a very hot climate, summer, Mediterranean, hot tempers, and everyone being a bit volatile. And I thought you could explain the volatility of the behaviour because of the post-war, the trauma people have lived through, and that perhaps some of the men are suffering from shell shock, or if not shell shock, they've certainly seen terrible things. And it was quite a good way of explaining some of the very erratic behaviour in the play. I suppose you could say that's rather superficial, but I sort of feel that it was important to honour that side of the war in presenting a play set at that time. And in different ways, say Don John with his evil or Dogberry with his comedy, they seem to work quite well coming out of a military background.
It does, for me, the Love's Labour's Lost production does twist at the end because we come from the lovely Nine Worthies, which is joyous.
Yeah.
You know, sort of Gilbert and Sullivan inspired.
Yes.
Pageant. And then the news comes.
Mm.
And then there is an epilogue that you've added, which absolutely twists that.
Yeah.
Gets us halfway along the story,
yes.
You know, in terms of then linking up to the second play. So
I think we could talk about that, could we? I think that's... Is that permissible?
I don't know.
I mean, because when you say you added an epilogue, I mean, the epilogue's in the play. I mean, we didn't... It's not like wrote something for it, but I just thought that because it's very interesting actually that Love's Labour's Lost finishes with a song and Much Ado finishes with a dance, as Shakespeare wrote them, and in a way, what was quite good I think about being presented with the concept when Greg said put it before the First World War, it meant that rather than me worrying about whether or not that was a good idea, I could just think about how best to do that. That was all it became about. Right, okay, that's the idea, that's what we're going to do. How can I best suggest that? And it was quite easy with the bulk of the play just to think of it as Edwardian. But I wanted to suggest to the audience at the end that we are heading off into the First World War, because it's not explicit in the text, obviously, that no one actually says, now go to war, your country needs you or anything. So we had to kind of suggest it. And I felt that the obvious way to do that was that the song, at the very end of the play, they do this Nine Worthies pageant event and put on a little show, rather in the manner of Midsummer Night's Dream with the mechanicals, they put on a show, and an amateur production. And then I thought, well, at the end of that, they finish that, and then they say, before we go, can we just sing the last song that we were going to do at the end of the show? So I thought, well, we could use the lyric that Shakespeare wrote. And obviously there's no existing music, so we had to choose what the music would be. And we thought, well, we've got a great composer. We could ask him to write a pastiche of something patriotic and maybe along the lines of Ivor Novello, keep the home fires burning sort of feel. And I thought that would be a really fresh way to hear that song, the Owl and the Cuckoo song, the When Days Is Pied. And I just sort of felt that was a neat idea and took it to Nigel, and he wrote this incredible song. Sorry, everyone, you'll well up.
I know, you will well up.
That I was actually, when I first heard it, I asked him to have a go at doing this, and I knew he'd do it brilliantly, but I was working, I should just tell you this little anecdote, that I was working in, at the time, this was in about January this year, in Australia. I was directing the Rocky Horror Show in Australia. So I, nothing if not Catholic in my tastes, and I was in Adelaide, in a hotel in Adelaide, and Nigel sent me an MP3 down the computer. I'm relatively computer literate. And I sat in my hotel room. I woke up really early, because you do when you're at the time difference and all that. And I was at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I put on this MP3, and I was sitting there in my hotel room weeping this beautiful music. And it's incredible.
Yes, you'll see it. And you'll be taken on a fun, absolutely fun-loving journey.
Yeah.
And then at that point, you'll go...
the laughter will freeze on your lips.
But there you go. Then you have to come back and watch Much Ado About Nothing. Yeah. Love's Labour's won, I should say. Thank you very much for
giving us
a little insight into your world. And thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much to Christopher.
Thank you, Nikki. Thank you.